the frequency of business today doesn't operate on a 10-year cycle. It operates maybe on a, 12-month or, from any business out there, if they can show me what they're going to be doing in 5 years, I'd be astounded.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Make More Podcast. I'm Matt Hessen. I'm your host. I have got a special treat for you today. I've got a guy on camera here with me. He was not, when I was a young man, my dad used to say, when you go into the room, look for the smartest guy in the room and talk to him. Well, I found the smartest guy in the room, and he's with us today. His name is Joe Brady, and Joe has been not only a colleague of mine, but a great friend for the last 25 years. And Joe, welcome.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here with you. You're one of my favorite people, and I'm so proud of what you're doing here with Making More, and I'm honored that you'd asked me to join you today, so it's great to be here.
When I met Joe, you were at, I think it was the video.
Well, yeah, we were, at Hollywood Video back when that, Matt, if you remember, that was actually an industry that had acted. There's only one video store left in the whole country, I think, and it's the one Blockbuster, and it's in Bend, Oregon. But yeah, we were at Hollywood Video.
Hollywood Video.
Yeah. And in 2000, the music stopped, and you were our first client in a company called the Standard Group that I co-founded. So I owe a lot to you.
Well, Joe, it was wonderful because we were able to, through your leadership and Branson and Mark and Luke, to take our company, shave a whole millions of dollars out of G&A and redeploy that into the real estate rather than into overhead. And that was your brainchild, and I was able to sell it to the company, but it was definitely your brainchild. Joe, you also were with the Standard Group as a principal for how many years?
That was 8 years. We wound up selling that business to JLL in 2008. So you're exaggerating a little on the smart side of things. I'll take lucky, and I'm grateful. We had good timing when we sold the Standard Group. Matt, that was January 3rd, 2008, when we closed with JLL. So for a 20-person company, it was nice to have safe harbor during the global economic crisis.
Well, and then you went on to be the divisional vice president of real estate at Walgreens, running that $4 billion portfolio, right?
Well, that was the annual operating expense, $4 billion. It was 150 million square feet, Dow 30 company, over 9,000 stores. And you know what, Matt? When I showed up, they were literally managing most of it on an Excel spreadsheet, which was pretty frightening.
Wow.
We can talk about property technology and business intelligence at another time, but there was a lot of work to be done there.
Well, Joe's also was the CEO of the Americas of the Instant Group and founder of his own company, Guinness Advisors LLC. Joe, can you tell us a little bit about Guinness, what Guinness is up to?
Well, I have a development company called Guinness Development that I've used for 30 years. My wife Shannon and I, who despite her name is more than half Italian, and you know her, Matt.
I do.
Lovely lady. We love to travel, and way back when we were at St. James Gate, which is the Guinness factory in Dublin. And everyone else was focused on getting to the end of the tour to get the free Guinness. And I'm listening to the docent who said, Sir Arthur Guinness struck a deal for 200 acres along the Liffey River in Dublin for a term of 10,000 years and rent of £10 per year with no escalations. So I thought that was a pretty darn good real estate deal. So I named my development company Guinness, and then Guinness Advisors is the advisory vehicle where I work with companies on the future of work, future communities, future retail, and where I do writing and so forth.
My daughter just walked in the back room. This is Brittany. Awesome. Brittany, this is Joe Brady.
Hey, Brittany.
Hi.
How are you?
I remember my younger sister.
I'm Maddie, the one that gave you the cookie.
I remember you distinctly, and I don't want to sound old and say, oh, you were this tall, but anyway, I love your Christmas cards. You're wonderful.
Hey. So one of the things that I want to touch on, Joe, is, you know, I know that you've just joined a new organization as a partner with LRG Investors. I did some research on LRG. It's a pretty impressive group. What are you guys doing?
You know, Matt, you and I have been in this industry a long time, and the commercial real estate industry is interesting. If you're going to have staying power, you need to have character, integrity. And a fellow named Steve Cutter, who is, you know, Cutter, based in the Bay Area 20 some years ago, started Lockhouse Retail Group, which has now grown to be the largest retail brokerage company in Northern California, with offices in Santa Barbara and LA as well. And 9 years ago, with a partner, Josh Amoroso, Steve founded Lockhouse Retail Group as the development and investment arm to help Lockhouse with their 135 different tenants that they were representing. So I've known Steve for a very long time. Not only is he a friend, but he's been a valuable work colleague. And we've talked about partnering in the past. I left my last job in June of 23 and took a little 9-month sabbatical. Did a bunch of fun stuff, which we can talk about if you're interested. But
definitely.
Yeah, but I reached out to Steve to say, I think the timing's right. I'd love to do this. And so LRG Investors has a dual mandate. And the first part is serving as a preferred developer for credit tenant, retail tenants. And you know this better than anybody, but for those that are listening and don't know, where we serve as an extension of a retailer's real estate department, and we're able to go out and help that retailer find sites, but then we'll buy the land, we'll build the building, we'll do the whole fit out, and then turn it over to the retailer so that they can open at speed. It's something that I've experienced, I've done before in the past. I've experienced when I was at Walgreens, and it's a fairly common practice. So that's exciting. The first part is really preferred development. The second part is strategic investment in value add retail centers. So they may be anchored with a grocery store, or they may be unanchored, but they're definitely all about daily needs. And we know, Matt, and you've seen this and you've watched it through the years, where the retail apocalypse that supposedly was going to happen, which never happened, really created a massive stall in net new builds. And so what retailers are finding today is a really dangerous lack of supply of quality real estate. And so we feel like this is a great time to capitalize on that. LRG has been really successful from Denver West. They've done over $300 million in development and acquisitions. I'm now in Florida, in Northern Florida, Jacksonville. And we have a colleague, Aaron Dan, in Orlando. So now we have East Coast coverage, and we're really going to capitalize on the demographics that are happening from, call it, the Carolinas, south to Florida, west to Texas. The demographics are destiny, and there's literally 1,200 people a day moving to Florida. Matt, I mean, it's...
Yo, hey, let me interrupt for a second. What are you seeing? I mean, I know you study trends quite a bit, and you study very vast amounts of data. What leads you to believe that now is a good time to be getting into a commercial real estate, retail specifically?
Yeah, retail specifically, you know, if you think about the population growth in the United States, GDP growth over the last 10 years, if you think about other investments, the stock market, and if you look at the amount of GLA, gross leasable area, that's been built for retail, it's really been a fraction of the economic growth of every other indicator that you would look at. And we've actually seen a net decline in overall GLA because, you know, most C malls don't exist anymore. They've been demoed or they've been converted. B malls, you know, likewise have gone through a metamorphosis. You know, you're seeing an awful lot of space that is either coming offline, being, you know, it's this notion of creative destruction, right? Where it maybe was a video store one day, it's scraped, and now it's a Raising Cane's, or it's a Chick-fil-A, or, you know, it's a Chase Bank. So from our perspective, we're really seeing a need by retailers. Target is looking at opening another 300 stores, and they're not the small stores. They're 128,000 to 138,000 square feet.
Right.
So much of this new growth is needed, Matt, in order to really capitalize on the last mile logistics challenges that retailers have, but that are embedded in what we call omni-channel retail. So,
hey, Joe, explain to the viewers the last mile distribution and how the metamorphosis in retail has changed some of those buildings' uses to last mile distribution, and
sure,
how that benefits the consumer and what that looks like going forward.
The consumer retail spend in the U.S. is $3 trillion. And what we saw before the pandemic was that e-commerce sales were probably at around 8 or 9%. Through the pandemic, we saw a bit of a spike, which makes sense. Many stores were closed. We had a heavy reliance on Amazon and other click and collect, or what's called buy online, pick up in store type of activities for groceries, Target, Walmart, et cetera. Now we're seeing e-commerce level off at 9 to 10% of total retail sales.
Really?
And so what you have are companies like Target, who now have taken their physical footprint. They've looked at what Amazon has done, and Amazon was obviously digitally native. That's now gone into bricks and mortar with Whole Foods and with their own branded stores. But they've seen that the consumer, and you know, as we talk about future of work, Matt, we're going to talk a lot about consumer primacy, because what we've seen is that the consumer wants agency, autonomy, and optionality in how she spends her money, how she votes with her wallet. So that might mean that you buy online, but then go to a physical store and pick it up. And so that store has to have the inventory there to accommodate the consumer.
Sure.
It could be that you want to order something today. You want to have same day delivery. And in major metros like LA or New York, you can often get Amazon delivered the same day. But if you have a Walgreens, or if you have a Kroger, or if you have a Target that's within 2 miles of your house, whether it's, you know, Uber or some of the other delivery services, the businesses, the retailers, are able to satisfy consumer demand. And that consumer demand is going to continue to change and evolve. So in order to have that last mile, could be last half mile, it's going to be really, really important to have the physical brick and mortar structure, the the supply chain infrastructure that then can really meet the consumer where they are and where they want to be.
Interesting. But is it for the viewing audience's edification, do you continue to see the rollout of last mile distribution facilities? Is there going to be more of that?
I do. I mean, I think all of us have traveled around and we've seen the massive Amazon facilities, right? And you're probably, Whole Foods has essentially become a mini last mile distribution center for Amazon. Now, you have the lockers there where you can actually return anything that you bought on Amazon that you don't want, right? Super easy. Just put it in the locker. But now you're seeing more and more of the cafe areas that were in Whole Foods that are being transformed into the last mile distribution center. So there's all sorts of really creative ways that I was just in New York this week for the Urban Land Institute ULI conference. And, any block you travel down, you'll see hordes of people in Amazon jumpers organizing packages and putting them on bikes. Yeah. And, it's just amazing seeing how this whole thing is unfolding in front of your eyes. So I think, Matt, that there's going to be more as the consumer demands faster, better, cheaper. The retailers are going to have to continue to evolve.
Let me ask you to elaborate on that for one sec. Mm-hmm. With the inflation that we're facing right now, and the cost of everything skyrocketing, and people are actually, I think, is the consumer not dialing back on their purchases? And how does that feed the pipeline for new retail product going forward?
70% of the U.S. GDP is consumer spending. Right. So I don't know if the consumer's pulling back that much right now. But I also think we have to stratify what's happening. You have very, very high end New York Fifth Avenue, Chanel, Gucci, Prada, et cetera, that continue to do really well. And then you have the dollar stores, which, are going through a little bit of a hiccup right now. We saw where 99 cent only is really folding up shop. It's surprising, but for the last 5 or 6 years, Dollar Tree and Dollar General both have opened almost 1,000 stores each a year. So,
and do you think the inflation, the shrink, and rising labor and occupancy costs drove that model, into the tank for certain operators?
Well, I don't view inflation as the biggest boogeyman out there retail headwinds. But you talked about occupancy costs, and occupancy costs for new buildings are definitely impacted by increased interest rates. And so there's increased input costs on construction, and labor remains a massive issue. We're at near full employment. And so anyone that's working on any sort of project anywhere knows it's really tough to get quality people on site delivering on track, on time, on budget. You really struck on another massive headwind that's happening. And this could dovetail into kind of a geopolitical discussion, but the notion of organized retail crime is a massive problem in the United States, particularly in I'll call it northern cities, where we've seen penalties for shoplifting for items below $999, equivalent to a jaywalking ticket. And so what you find is that the front of the house, and I can speak from a Walgreens perspective, the front of the house in many of these cities turned into what I call payment optional. In other words, if you and I get in there, right, and we actually pay for it, it's almost like you're doing a great deed. And the organized The organized retail crime is a real thing. You know, there's a Tony Soprano of the dark supply chain that's sending in very low level boosters, and you know, they're literally doing entire swipes of shelving for body wash, razors, liquid Tide, you know, all of these items that could get resold very quickly, either through e-commerce channels or in the case of say New York City, they wind up in smaller stores or bodegas out in, you know, in the different boroughs.
So they're literally stealing product and reselling it at their own stores.
Not at their own stores. It's sort of that dark supply chain where it gets stolen from a Walgreens or a Duane Reade in New York City. Somehow it gets routed very quickly out and to third parties that, you know, are looking to make a living. They probably don't know they're buying stolen merchandise necessarily, but it's happening to the tune of $100 billion a year. This is a research study done by ICSC, which, Matt, as you know, is an industry trade group for retail and consumer real estate in the U.S. And that $100 billion number might even be an underestimation of actually what's happening. I'll tell you, when I was at Walgreens, the team, Walgreens acquired a brand called Duane Reade. So if any of your listeners are in New York or know New York, there's Duane Reade's on almost every corner. And the loss prevention team used a Sharpie. This was sort of a very simplistic approach, but used a Sharpie and wrote DR on the bottom of Häagen-Dazs ice cream cartons. And that dark supply chain was so efficient that an item could get stolen from Midtown Manhattan and wind up somewhere in Queens in a bodega and not melt. So we can talk about that. There's things that are happening. They're starting to break up some chain, you know, organized retail crime chains, but every single retailer that you encounter will talk about ORC or organized retail crime as a major headwind.
Wow. Yeah, I've seen that on the news quite a bit. A lot of smash and grabs and just, you know, just a whole crowd of kids running in and just stealing all the merchandise from Target, running out with TVs. And I mean, it's absolutely, yeah, you've seen more and more retailers closing their doors because of that. Organized crime.
You have, and what happens is, you know, I think there was a fairly In-N-Out Burger just closed, I think, one of their first stores in Oakland, just because it's not safe for employees, it's not safe for customers, and that's just a sad statement on where we are in some cities, which is really unfortunate, but I will tell you this, Matt, you know, and when you and I were talking about scheduling our time together, we were talking about work from home. And what I would tell you is work from home is one part of hybrid work. And I think there's a really interesting conversation to be had about the future of work. Because the future of work means the future of our communities.
Yes.
And, you know, you and I both grew up in the retail industry, and we did so together, shoulder to shoulder. We even went to places like Milpitas, if you remember that.
Milpitas. Boy, that brings back some memories.
Yeah, it brings back some nightmares for me. But anyway, I had to deal with your wrath with that one. You looked at me.
Oh my God!
Where are we in Milpitas?
So for our listeners, Joe and I not only been great friends for 25 years, but when Joe had the Standard Group, we would work. He worked for us as an outside consultant, helping us roll out our real estate stores. And not only did he do a great job, but we had some ventures and adventures, I'll say. that we can talk about, but we need to say we've had some really good times together.
Yes, we have. And, yes, we have.
So how are you enjoying Florida?
We are loving Florida. So we're in Ponte Vedra Beach, which isn't very well known, but we're north of St. Augustine, and we're in the Jacksonville market. TPC Sawgrass, for the golfers out there, is about a mile away, and the PGA Tour headquarters is right adjacent to TPC Sawgrass. So this is sort of golf central on the East Coast, but certainly Augusta takes the cake today. The Masters.
You need to go into the litany of every reason why you made the move, but can you share with our listeners? I'm sure you're like a lot of people, 1,000 people a day moving to Florida. Was it the organized crime element? Was it the political side of things? What drove your decision to move to Florida? Just out of curiosity.
You know, it was life work balance, which is a departure from work life balance. And my kids are out of the house.
Joey and Gracie are both gone.
Establishing themselves. Yeah, Grace is in Scotland. She did her undergraduate at the University of St. Andrews in sustainable development. Now she's back getting her master's in marine biology. Wow. And, you know, is really doing some extraordinary research, particularly in Antarctic fisheries. In fact, she's going to Tasmania for 3 months in May to do more research, which is fabulous. And Joey is out close to you, living in LA, working in Santa Monica in tech. So the kids were up and out. My wife and I really didn't have any other blood family in the Chicago area. We lived in Chicago for 30 years and lived in the same community, Hinsdale, for 20 years where we raised our kids. You were at the house. And
oh, yeah.
Just a lovely area. But, you know, we had the opportunity to relocate. And as we were thinking about where to go, I was the CEO of the Americas for the Instant Group, which is the Airbnb of flexible office space. We also worked as a preferred interiors developer for major corporates. So Amazon, American Express, GSK, Netflix, Dow Jones, we would go and build out space for them. And so we were establishing an office in Mexico City. We had a group, an office in Buenos Aires. We built Netflix's office in Buenos Aires. So I found myself spending a lot of time in Latin America. Florida made a lot of sense. But truthfully, Matt, as we thought about, you know, our calculus was we're not getting any younger. We want to move somewhere that has a good airport. Jacksonville is fabulous. Healthcare. I know you've talked a lot about your health and you're winning.
Kicking ass.
You're kicking ass, which I couldn't be more proud of you.
Thank you.
And I would expect nothing less from you. But there's a Mayo Clinic 6 miles from our house here. So Jacksonville really has some fabulous benefits, and not the least of which, it was somewhat, as a real estate guy, it was somewhat of an unpriced trend in Florida. Just as an example, houses in our community, we're in a golf course community, they were trading at 3 years ago at maybe $250 to $275 a square foot. They're now trading at $500 a square foot.
Wow.
And going up. And by the way, there's nothing for you to buy here either. It's just, there's such an inflow. But you know, Matt, family is a big important part. And my parents spend the winter in Sanibel Island. Right. My sister and brother-in-law live there. And as it turned out, we wound up moving my father-in-law from Michigan to Florida, Jacksonville Beach. He's been suffering with dementia. So, you know, it's just been a really a good, I would say, a good reset for us. And, you know, a lot of vitamin D, a lot of palm trees.
So tell me, how's Pam doing? Where is she?
Well, yeah, still keeping busy and writing movies. And she was able, because she does a lot of work in animated comedy and movies, she was able to work through the strikes. And so, yeah, she's doing really well.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can get the sense. Here's Joe Brady, the smartest guy in the room. I mean, just listen to this. I'm just proud of you, Joe. I'm going to brag on you for a second. He's got an artificial intelligence certification from MIT. Let's talk about that for a second. Who goes and gets an artificial intelligence certification from MIT and a behavioral economics certification from University of Chicago? I mean, ladies and gentlemen, we're not talking to some ordinary human being here. We're talking about some guy who's he is the smartest guy in the room. Which is why I put him on the wall. And he's funny as fuck. So, he's just funny as fuck. So we're having a good time together. Hey, Joe, tell me about AI. How's AI going to play into the real estate world?
You know, I had this real deep interest in blockchain as it relates to real estate. And when you think about blockchain, it's, you know, my kind of meatball math approach to it is, you know, there's a giant Excel spreadsheet in the sky, in the ether, that has, you know, thousands and thousands of connections, such that one particular cell can put the provenance or ownership of an item. You know, it could be a plot of dirt, it could be a painting, it could be anything. It could be an NFT, non-fungible token, that, you know, you see on the, and it occurred to me that the technology that was being used for Bitcoin and, you know, other crypto was really innovative. And there was a lot going on out there, particularly on the fringe. And maybe some of it was getting nefarious. And, you know, there was some black market activity happening with Bitcoin or with cryptocurrency. But the underlying technology, for me, I thought was really, really fascinating. Because when you think about it, and listen, you're one of the biggest real estate guys I know. How have you ever, Matt, have you ever been able to go to your title insurance company, file a claim, and get any money back?
No.
And you, I mean, I couldn't even begin to estimate how much money you've paid to title insurance companies over the years.
Right.
It's, you know, I'm just pissed that I didn't start a title insurance company.
I'm surprised you don't own one.
I got an idea, Matt, for us to do next. So I was thinking this, you know, I was thinking there's this idea where at some point, and there have been some interesting experiments happening. There was a guy in Chicago that was taking residential titles and putting it on the blockchain. But at some point, there will be this evolution from, you know, just paper to technology and blockchain. And you know, we can track liens. You can do everything that you need to do. But I felt like there was something that needed to happen along that technology. And likewise, when it came to leases, right? So how many leases have you been a part of in your life? Like, very
thousands.
And why are they still paper, right? Why aren't they blockchain smart contracts? When I showed up at Walgreens, Matt, one of the questions I asked was, what's our outstanding TI? For the listeners, when retailers like Walgreens go to a developer like Matt Heslin, we'll say, Matt, go, you know, build a building here. We'll pay a certain amount of rent. And as an inducement, you'll provide a certain amount of tenant improvement dollars back that almost helps fund the FF, and it helps fund the development for the company. And, you know, for a Walgreens, that could be upwards of $1 million a store. So I just happened to ask the question, what is the outstanding TI? And it took a couple of days, but finally someone came back and said, oh, it's only $50 million. And literally my mouth dropped. So this is $50 million of Walgreens money that they should have in their coffers. And it was just sitting out there. And frankly, the developers, you know, probably weren't totally focused on it and wasn't anything pernicious or nefarious. Just, hey, Walgreens didn't ask and the developers didn't pay. But if you had a smart contract, essentially what happens then is that TI becomes an if-then statement. In other words, if Walgreens submits the final lien waiver, then the tenant improvement gets released by a third party, you know, maybe it's a title insurance company, whoever's the intermediary holding the funds. So those are the types of things, Matt, I was thinking about. And then, you know, you just sort of read about this generative AI. And as I said, I had this sabbatical. And so there were two key areas that I really wanted to understand better. And the AI and business strategy was definitely one of them. And when you think about artificial intelligence, it's really a catch-all for generative AI bots. Another discipline called machine learning. And then it also dovetails into robotics as well. And, you know, I think we all get robotics. The machine learning part is really fascinating. And everyone talks about how data is, you know, the next gold and data's oil and all that other stuff. In some instances, data is oil, meaning it's in the ground and it has potential. It has potential energy or potential value, but unless and until it's extracted, refined, marketed, and then sold, then it becomes kinetic. It becomes, you know, active and valuable. So having data is not the issue. In fact, we have way too much data that it's really, really difficult to mine. And so what these machine learning tools do is take extraordinarily large amounts of data and starts to develop pattern recognition. And it's the type of pattern recognition that you and I, even though, you know, been to schools and we've studied, you know, we would never in a million years be able to pull out the pattern recognition that a working machine can do. So, you know, that seemed really interesting to me from a real estate perspective, because you're dealing with, even if you're dealing with 9,000 retail stores, and each retail store has four rooftop units, and you're trying to manage and understand when they're going to break or how to fix them, it's just an ungodly amount of information to process. But if you're using machine learning or you have generative AI bots searching and monitoring, there's a good opportunity that you can start catching stuff before it breaks.
But right.
The other thing, and we were talking about leases, Matt, in 2017, there was a pretty devastating hurricane that came through South Texas. And there were about 100 Walgreens stores that were impacted, some totally destroyed, some damaged. And I asked the team to evaluate our position based on lease terms. And they literally had to get a team of 8 people. It took 2 weeks to physically go through every one of those leases and come out and then really summarize things. So 8 people, 2 weeks, 640 man hours, let's say $25 an hour. That one request cost $16,000, took 2 weeks, and was probably about 60% accurate.
And with AI, all that is just boom.
The theory would be if you had a AI tool that ingested all of your leases, you could just, it would be a couple of swipes on the keyboard and you'd have your answer. So, you know, for me, diving in through the MIT course was fun and exciting, you know. And I guess how I'd summarize it is it's a force multiplier. In other words, you and I can go out and dig a hole with a shovel. We each have a shovel, but someone smarter would come in with you know, one of those massive earth movers, you know, with one fell scoop, there'd be a ton of dirt removed. And in many respects, that's kind of the power of Gen AI right now. And it's just getting more and more powerful.
Joe, have you, what else are you seeing from the consumer? You know, 2008 was obviously a big challenge for the economy. We rolled into COVID. You know, behavioral changes pre-COVID, post-COVID in the consumer. What kind of behavioral changes have evolved?
Yeah, I think it's really the consumer primacy element where, Matt, I think people, U.S. consumers from 1999 on started to experience a liberation. They were able to develop agency, autonomy, and optionality in how they spend their money. A lot of it had to do with technology accelerating. You know, when you and I first came into the retail business, shop was a noun. It was a brick and mortar. It was a place people went to. And right. Because of Amazon and, you know, and because of, you know, iPhones and smartphones, shop became a verb, right? It was a thing people did irrespective of place. Now, that's where this notion of omni-channel retail came about. And when you think about our patterns and behaviors before the pandemic from a work perspective, work and office were largely still synonymous, weren't they? Right.
Yes.
You know, you'd say to Coral, I'm going to work. Well, that meant you're going to your office. But
correct.
I mean, how many times would you be in a car or on a plane or, you know, at a meeting and not really recognize the notion that work was happening there? But because we had this 2.5 year pause where everyone, I would say 95% of the working population wound up staying home. Many businesses realized that activity could happen and it's not necessary to physically be in that office. Right. You know, and why do we go to offices? Why do we work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5? And I think what we have are these anachronistic practices that, you know, are left over from the agrarian age, from the industrial age, right? Like in the industrial age, you went to the factory because that's where the inputs came in. And
right.
You pulled a lever of the machine and then an output went out. But we're now in this conceptual age. I call it the keyboard economy right now, right? Where if there are 160 million workers in the United States today, near 100 million fall into this keyboard economy, right? Where it could be lower level clerical or it could be higher level executive, but there's about 100 million people that don't have to behave like they work at a factory.
So they're working from home, right? A great portion of us people are probably working from home or working remotely out on the road or wherever their meetings are or whatever. That's, you go for Starbucks, whatever.
Those third places, yeah. I mean, we always talked about the third place. Howard Schultz always talked about third place Starbucks. And boy, there was a lot of people working. There's a lot of people working there. And then now you've seen this proliferation of flexible office. And obviously WeWork got a lot of press. Adam Neumann is a, you know, larger than life character. They had a, you know, just a violent crash to earth and, you know, all this other stuff. Still, they've done a fabulous job establishing flexible office as a category. And they're small compared to the overall industry, but they just really punched above their weight. So, you know, this notion of, and you asked about the consumer, Matt, and so now post-pandemic, we're seeing work go through the same metamorphosis that shop went through.
Interesting.
Office and work are now decoupled, and work has gone from that noun to a verb, right? From a place you went to a thing you do, irrespective of place. And some people work at home, but I think if you start, you look at certain demographics, young people really want to be in an office. First of all, it's a target-rich environment if you're looking for a mate, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then you find your mate and you get in your 30s and 40s and you're having kids and you really don't want to, you either want to stay home or you want to get away from home, right? I was very fortunate in that my wife, Shannon, is my partner and was the CEO of the home. I couldn't have done what I've done without having Shannon do the really hard job. Right.
And amen. Amen.
So I would say that there are instances now where people have optionality. And so the trend is happening where you're going to go to an office. But why are you going to an office? There's this notion of a return on commute calculation that workers are doing now. If you live in Orange County and, your office is 10 miles away, that might take 45 minutes to drive. Right. If you're living in Westchester County, north of New York City, and you're taking the train into Grand Central each day, that train commute could be anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half, depending upon where you live. So that's 2 to 3 hours a day wiped out. And on average, we calculated the commuting cost for a suburban New Yorker. It's about $8,000 a year after tax. Wow. So if you're my boss, Matt, and you're telling me I need to be in the office 5 days a week in Midtown Manhattan, but 3 of those days I'm just sitting here on a video call, I'm going to start thinking I could probably go work somewhere else. And I think we definitely saw those trends happening. Or I might just say, I'm not going to come in on Mondays or Fridays. Which,
Joe, do you think that the productivity of the average American worker has increased as a result of this decoupling?
I would say it is the data. And there's a great professor and researcher named Nick Bloom at Stanford. And he, interestingly enough, has been doing research on work from home for about 20 years. Oh, so wow. You talk about becoming an overnight success. I mean, brilliant guy. He's pretty out there and available on different podcasts. And I would say his research had suggested that he has seen upwards of a 30% increase in productivity and as low as a 13% decrease. So I hate to say that the answer to your question, Matt, is it depends, right? I sound like an economist, but it really does depend on what I think is leadership, not management. In the future of work, simply mandating that someone comes in or simply falling victim to the fallacy that just because someone is in the office sitting at their assigned cubicle, that they're being productive is just blatantly wrong. I call it Dilbert management, right? And what we need are leaders that acknowledge that coming together is a really important part of being human and of being a productive and effective worker. But what we're seeing now is this notion of on-site being the new off-site, right? On-site, gathering people in an office now requires more curation, right? It's almost like work is entering into the experiential era, just like retail has too, right? Like, why do you go to Lululemon? You don't just go there to buy yoga clothes, right? You go there to be part of the experience. You might take a yoga class. And the Apple, right? I mean, no better example of building community, movement, experience than Apple. You just want to be there. You know, I find it interesting that JP Morgan is building their new headquarters building at 270 Park Avenue, and they're using Foster and Associates, the same architect that Apple uses that built his headquarters. They built Foster and Associates built the GM Square and I think almost all of the Apple stores. And so, you know, there's something to it in this connection between hybrid work and omni-channel retail. I argue are two sides of the same coin, and it's all about consumer primacy. So whether that consumer is spending money with you and you're a retailer, or they're making money working for you as an employee, there's very similar characteristics that we need to take into consideration. And so, you know, and again, it goes back to this notion of agency, autonomy, and optionality. And if I'm working for you, Matt, and you tell me, Joe, I need you to produce X number of sales calls, and I need you to deliver this level of revenue, do you really care what I do Monday through Friday? Or do you care if I work in the morning and I hit golf balls in the afternoon and then I work at night? Or, you know, we're really entering into an era of effectiveness more than productivity. And I argue that effectiveness is contributing to the enterprise value and the enterprise goals. Productivity, I could call you up, Matt, and say, hey, Matt, I just sent 100 emails today. And you might say, Joe, that's great. But, you know, are any of them effective? Like, is that leading to anything? Were you sending them to the right people? And so just doing work for work's sake and saying you're being productive falls into that Dilbert category from my perspective.
That's really well put. You know, can we talk about your book for a second?
Sure. Yeah.
Just for our listeners, just tack on one more freaking brilliant idea of Joe's. He's got a book coming out, which talks a lot about what he's touching on here. Joe, can you walk us through a little bit about the thesis of the book and the reason you wrote the book and when it's going to come out and where they can get it?
Happy to. Yes. The book is called Work Shop. So a lot of what we've been talking about here, and it's really the consumer driven transformation of commercial real estate. I'm in the final stages of editing. We'll be able to provide a link to Amazon by the end of May.
Make sure we get that.
It's all happening real time. I'll provide it to you for sure.
It's really interesting, fascinating. I mean, I'm learning so much just talking to you because, you know, the book itself, you know, I read just a brief synopsis that you sent me, and it's just interesting how you equate the decoupling of the office from work and shop and, you know, retail footprint being, you know, decoupled. And I suspect in your book you're going to talk a lot about what that means for the consumer primacy and what that means for the average worker and probably touch on a lot of that stuff, huh?
Yeah, and I do take a little bit of time and talk about how technology has evolved, because I really think there's three forces at play here. You have technological acceleration and disruption, which is then changing consumer behavior, and ultimately the real estate has to follow. And real estate, commercial real estate in particular, is old fashioned, right? Think about it. There's a lord in landlord and there's an ant in tenant. I mean, those concepts, landlord and tenant, are medieval in their origin. Yet we still use them. Businesses, developers and owners of commercial real estate, office in particular, have always looked at 10-year leases, you know, that you know, sign a lease for 10 years, set it and forget it. But business, the frequency of business today doesn't operate on a 10-year cycle. It operates maybe on a, 12-month or, from any business out there, if they can show me what they're going to be doing in 5 years, I'd be astounded. And yet, the inertia that's part of a $3 trillion office asset class and a $3.5 trillion retail class of real estate, the inertia is so strong that it's going to take a consumer uprising for to fight the force of that inertia. And I really think it's happening now. I mean, if you think about, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but upwards of 50% of office leases in the United States will mature or expire by the end of 2025. In addition, there's a wave of debt maturity that's happening at that same time. So what we're watching right now is a real slow moving car crash. We're not going to feel the dramatic Darwinian approach to the office asset class until, deep into 2025, 2026.
Do those properties then get sold and repurposed, or what happens to the office as we know it today?
I really feel like we've seen this movie before, and it was retail. And so what happened with retail? Saw a lot of demo. We saw a lot of reformatting where a Sears became a Lifetime Fitness it became any of a number of things. It became office. We saw malls that are converting outpads into multifamily. But Matt, I think there's a really, really important message, and I talk about this in the book, because nature abhors monocultures, right? Meaning if you plant the same crop in the same field every single year, the nutrients will degrade, the crop will fail. It's not healthy. And the word ecosystem gets used and batted around a bit, but I'm gonna use it again here, because I honestly believe what we're seeing in a lot of cities are examples of monocultures adjacent to healthy ecosystems. I'll go back to Chicago, my old hometown there for a while, and I'd say that the Chicago Loop, by and large, is experiencing a massive decline right now, because it's heavily reliant on one aspect of live, work, play, and that's the work part. But if you go, Matt, and I could take you 2 miles to the west to what's called Fulton Market, and you go from this CBD, core business district, to this what I call BBDs, a better business district, you have live, work, play. You know, you have Google that showed up there almost 10 years ago, and created this coolness and created this gravity that we always talk about, retail gravity, as whether it was a Smart and Final or it was a traditional grocery store, that becomes retail gravity for consumers to show up to 2 or 3 times a week. Well, what Google wound up doing in this Fulton Market area is establishing this point of gravity where it was really interesting for people to work in an area that used to be the old meatpacking district, and it had lots of loft buildings that were converted into residential. So you had the live component, and then the play element with restaurants and theater and all sorts of other things started establishing itself. But once Google was there, then McDonald's moved their world headquarters from Oak Brook, Illinois, down into this area. In fact, where the McDonald's world headquarters is today was Harpo Studios, where Oprah produced for years and years and years. But now, you see a healthy ecosystem of live, work, play, where you have 7 days a week of consumer activity. And you go over to the Loop, And before the pandemic, you maybe had 4 days a week, 4.5 days a week of daytime population. Now you had some, tourism that was happening, certainly around the lakefront, but you know, deep in the loop itself, now you're only seeing about 2 days of daytime population. So Matt, if you put your retail hat on and say, how am I going to get a deal approved if I only have 2 days of daytime pop? It doesn't work. And for the food and beverage and the services that are left there, how do they stay in business? And so we're starting to see this notion of an urban doom loop that's happening, where it's, you know, businesses are fleeing, tax revenue is declining, and then these municipalities have a choice, right? They can either tax whoever's left, and good luck with that, blood from a turnip, blood from a stone, or they start cutting city services. And so, you know, it's bad and worse from a decision perspective. And then you start to spiral, and you get to the point where you're Detroit in 1972, and, you know, the urban real estate's probably more valuable as agriculture than it is for residential or anything else. Yeah. Now, I mentioned Detroit because there's hope. You know, Dan Gilbert, Rocket Mortgage, is coming to spend well over $5 billion establishing live, work, play, anchored by sports venues that have allowed businesses to come and relocate, and residentials come in, and the grocery store. And then, so part of kind of this future of work is about the future of our communities. And I'll really come back to that, because right now, this Nick Bloom, who I referenced earlier from Stanford, talks about this donut effect. And in the middle of the donut, there's not much, right? There's just the hole. And that's what's happening in a lot of these declining urban areas. Think San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia. I mean, a lot of these northern cities that rely on mass transit from the suburbs coming in, people are voting with their feet and saying, I'm going to stay in the suburbs. And as a result, the retail in the suburbs has gone from, you know, 3-4 day a week daytime pop to 7 day a week firm, like both full families are there. So what we're seeing is this resurgence of activity happening in the suburbs, and now this renewed interest in having flexible workspace out in the suburbs. So if you do have to get out of your house for whatever reason, you can then go and find an industrial internet connection and a printer, and you know, interact with some other people. So it's a really, really interesting time.
Hey, Joe, going back to your Detroit example, our Rocket Mortgage put $5 billion into the live, work, play renaissance. I mean, Detroit is really on its way back up, really big time. Don't you think, we're seeing the degradation in San Francisco, we're seeing the degradation in L.A., Chicago, the big metros, like you're talking about, the death spiral. But at some point, a lot like South Beach, Florida, you know, at some point the real estate becomes so cheap, and so it becomes such a massive amount of it available for cheap that a renaissance inevitably happens. Don't you see that kind of coming back full circle in some of these communities that are on their backs right now?
Yeah, I'm optimistic. You know that, Matt. But. You have to be realistic as to how long it's going to take. You know, how far will these CBDs go? And who? It's going to be, it will invariably require a public-private partnership. You know, the local civic leaders can't do it themselves.
No.
There's another great example of a downtown resurgence in Tampa, in a project called Water Street that was started by a fellow named Jeff Vinnick, who used to run Magellan Funds for Fidelity. And so he anchored the downtown of Tampa, which really was, many people don't know there's a downtown Tampa.
Yeah.
But he Bought the Tampa Bay Lightning hockey franchise, built the Amalie Arena that he owns, Marriott, JW Marriott, Marriott's there. And then he started bringing in healthcare, education, grocery, residential, and again, started creating this live, work, play, healthy ecosystem. And that's what we need to be focused on. So, you know, I'm not sure how deep the spiral needs to go before someone can stop it and then really start focusing on the live, work, play, healthy ecosystem aspect. Because we know that that's a winning formula. We, you know, you can go to a lot of different markets. Yeah. You can go to any market and see where the live, work, play exists.
Yeah,
you have healthy businesses, and
sure. Is that the thesis of your book?
It is. It's this recognition. You know, you and I always used to love to talk politics back in the day, and you know, you remember old James Carville?
Oh yeah, sure.
Way back when, right?
Yeah.
And his favorite line was, "It's the economy, stupid."
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I'm paraphrasing by saying it's the consumer, stupid, right? Just because you own a piece of real estate doesn't mean you're going to make it really, really valuable in and of itself without acknowledging that there's a consumer aspect, that you're now in the experiential business, just like retailers have realized they're in the experiential business.
I love how you said the consumer was liberated. I think that is such a great line because, you know, likewise, you're saying that the worker is being liberated.
Yeah. Power to the people.
Power to the people. Viva el Duce.
Viva el Duce.
See, that's unbelievable. What a great topic. What a fun conversation to have.
I think with the book, Matt, I help frame more questions than I provide answers because, it's going to depend on who you are, what your business is, and hopefully I give enough context for you to then acknowledge some of the challenges and then apply some of the learnings that I share from different companies to say, maybe this is how we should think about doing things.
Well, you know, Joey, you've given me a lot of information for my own business. I mean, we're doing a lot of developments, but we're doing single tenant stuff right now. Mm-hmm. We work with a national grocery company where we do their fuel out parcels, like 100 of them, you know, 20 of them a year. We're doing 100 of them. And then we're now doing a live, work, play, a little less than full tilt with them. We're doing a hotel, employee housing, offices, at grocery store, and all the out parcels of the shopping center. So we're having to partner with different development teams. You know, one guy to do the hotel, one guy to do the multifamily, we'll do the retail. But we're taking that concept, and I can't wait for your book to come out because, it'll give me guidance as to, yeah, we're doing it the right thing, the right way. I mean, for the way the consumer is, primacy of the consumer, the decoupling of work from office. I mean, that's going to be really foremost, even not while I'm sitting here getting chills because like I'm in the middle of it right now. I didn't even know I was in the middle of it until you just told me. So I was really like I said, people, he's the smartest guy I know. So
no,
I'm just lucky to have airtime with you and not have to pay for it.
I'm just your friend.
No, great friend. Is there anything else you want to leave with the listeners, Joe?
Yeah, I just mention the life-work balance. I think there's some interesting beneficiaries, and those are parents with young kids who, you know, previously weren't able to see them in the morning or in the afternoon. Or, you know, I think we're in an era now where, you know, we can be more present and mindful and present in our families.
Yeah.
Going forward, you know, for those of us, you know, going through another stage of life where our parents are getting older and getting sick and need care, we can really be there for them as well. And I just think we're entering an era where we can be more human and caring and really focus on the things that matter. I know, Matt, you've been, you know, beyond brave and courageous talking about your, you know, your health issues, and not everyone has the liberty to address that or have people take care of them. Or I think when we can become focused on live work versus work live, we can become a better society. And, you know, again, I'm always optimistic and hopeful, and I think we need to get better as a society.
Dude, that's unbelievable. That's great stuff. That's great stuff. So are you developing any of your own projects now?
Well, with LRG, yeah, we've got a number of things percolating in the Carolinas and Florida. It's exciting. So we have more to talk about.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know you've got to run. I know you have some stuff you got to get done. I wanted to say thank you so much. Appreciate it. And not just coming on the podcast and sharing a wealth of information, but being my friend for 25 years. I don't say it enough. Thank you, because you've been a great friend.
You know, I've kind of learned that you have deal friends and then you have real friends. And real friends, you know, you and I, we could go a couple of years without talking, but then pick up instantly, you know, just based upon what we've experienced together, kind of the mutual love and respect. And I just feel like I was talking to somebody the other day about wealth. And for me, wealth isn't about how many zeros are in your bank account. But how many truly dear friends that you have in the world that you've collected. And, you know, it's advice I give to young people: collect as many people as you can. You know, it just brings joy and makes you laugh. And when you and I are together, we're always laughing.
So. We're always laughing. I remember when we were touring Italy and Andrea and myself, and what a great life experience that was.
It was.
I have two questions I have to ask you. Ask everybody. I already know what your answer is going to be based on the name of your company. Tell us what your favorite beer is. I think it tells us a lot about somebody.
People don't realize that Guinness is actually light beer. It's only 98 calories. So they had a marketing campaign that said Guinness is good for you. And that's what I believe. So yes, Guinness.
That's awesome. Okay. Last question. This is the Make More podcast. It's about making more out of your life, making more friendship, making more love, making more money, whatever. Tell me the one thing that you want to make more of in going forward.
I want to make more impact. As we get older, there's opportunities to impact younger generations. And I feel like as a leader through my career, I was always focused on the young people coming up, largely because I figured I was going to be working for them someday.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be nice to them. Yeah. But, you know, I think I feel like making an impact is having a multiplier effect when you have generations of people that you've had at least a small impact on, have gone out and hopefully multiplied that. So that's what I want to make more of.
Well, you're doing it. You're doing it. You know, I think your book, Joe, quite honestly, I think it'll be revolutionary for the real estate industry to read. I mean, every developer should be reading that. Every broker should be reading that. Your book's going to be very, you're talking about impact, right?
Yes.
I mean, that book is, if and it will get read and you will get published and it will be successful. But the point being, it's going to be very informative and very helpful for people in the real estate industry if they're open-minded enough to think a little differently. But, you know, a lot of guys can't do that. So
you'll get one of the first ones. How's that?
Get it autographed.
Okay, it's a deal.
All right, my friend. I love you. Have a great weekend. And then, you know, I'll catch up with you on the rebound.
I look forward to it. Great seeing you. Thanks so much.
Bye, Joe.